Well, it's time for us to be uplifted by the presence amongst us of Pastor Michael McCarty. The question is not, do you not know Michael, but who doesn't know Michael? Michael is ubiquitous. The same, by the way. He's in more than one place at once. Michael is a global professional storyteller. My daughter can still tell stories that she heard from him back when she was in the fourth grade. Michael will be hosting the storytelling festival happening at Mucka College Center here in Fullerton in the fall. Mr. McCarty is the only person that I know that celebrates Michaelmas, known as Christmas, but Michael works on that occasion. Michael will bring us today in touch with the world and its beautiful ideas about how we as humans relate to and are part of this great creation. I am very honored to be the publicist of today. Michael, please come up and meet me.
All right. This is where you applaud. Yes, yes. Oh, good morning. I am tickled beyond silliness to be here. So I'm going to be telling you some stories. Now, parents, the stories that I'm telling you, since your kids left, you can tell them like you made them up yourselves. So the idea is to tell some stories about the earth, our relationship with the earth, and some of the things, the songs that were sung, talked about the earth, our relationship with the creatures, the planet, and the people. So, I'm going to start with a familiar character. There's a story from West Africa, a trickster character named Anansi the Spider. And these are well-known stories throughout West Africa, the Caribbean, and just all over the world now. Anansi is a trickster, and he is often tricked. So this story is Anansi and the Palm Nut Tree. Now, the chief had called a meeting of everyone, all the people and all the creatures, because somebody was doing something wrong. You all might guess who that might be. Now, there were all of these things that were given to man and creatures to share and to take care of. But somebody was being greedy. So the chief had called everyone together, and the problem was the palm nut tree. Everyone used the palm nut tree for so many things. The leaves were used for roofs on the houses. The nuts were used to eat. There were all these different things about the tree that were being used, but somebody was tapping the good sap out of that tree to drink. That's a whole other story. Now, what happened when that happened was that when you took that sap out, well, little creatures would crawl up inside and eat the tree up from the inside out. So the chief called all the creatures, explained the situation, and said that we must not do this because we need this tree. Now, Anansi was at the meeting. But Anansi's attitude was like, that doesn't apply to me. I like the sap for that tree. Forget about this. And he immediately made plans to go out there and tap several trees. Now, the trees, because this is a folktale, knew what was going on. They saw him coming. They said, look at this Anansi. We give him so much. The chief has just told him, and here he is laying out all of his little things so he can tap us. We got to do something about this. The trees sort of huddled together. What are we going to do? Well, one tree said, well, I'm going to grow thorns. So when he tries to get me, he'll get stuck. Another tree said, well, if he climbs up on me, I'm going to shake and swing and shake and swing and he'll fall off. And another one said, well, if he climbs on me, I'm going to start growing real fast until he's so high that he can't get down. Well, that next day, when Anansi thought it was safe, he tipped on out there and he decided which tree he was going to tap first. He had a whole bunch of them lined up, but the tree he selected was the tree that was going to grow. Well, he got up on that tree, and he was starting to do all his tapping and wasn't even noticing how fast this tree was growing and growing and growing and growing. And all of a sudden, the tree said to Anansi, hey, Anansi, what? Who's talking to me? It's me. Take a look down. Whoa! Whoa! And Anansi got so freaked out, he fell. And now, this is before Anansi had a web. Okay, this is way back. And he fell and he grabbed onto one of the palm leaves. And he said, what's going on? He said, Anansi, You heard the chief. You know what's going on. You know how much we give you, and yet still you are about to tap us and cause us to die. You got to stop it, Anansi. We worked some things out. You try this, you're going to be in trouble. And then he said, well, I'm sorry, but help me, I can't get down. I'll stop, I promise, I'll stop. He said, okay, Nancy, I'll tell you what. I'm going to let you go down on the string from one of my leaves. And I tell you what, Nancy, you can keep that. You can keep that when you want to climb around and carry on. You can use that. Make yourself something, maybe a web. And that's how webs were formed. And Nancy, in this case, he learned his lesson. And he never messed with those palm nut trees again. And that's the end of that. One of the amazing things about folk tales is that these are stories that are centuries old, and yet they still deal with things that man is dealing with to this day. And unfortunately, one of the most common things that man has to deal with is greed. A friend of mine used to say, he who lives greedy dies hungry. And I'm sure you all have noticed that there's quite a bit of greed in the world. Well, this next story is an African-American folk tale. And this story is called Brer Tagger. You like it already. Brer Tagger and the Big Wind. Well, it was hard times for all of the creatures. It was really hard times. There was a great drought. Food, water, all of these things were drying up all over the forest, all over the jungle. But fortunately, there was one area where there was a spring that always ran with good, cool, clean water. And in the same field where there was a spring, there was this tree. It was a pear tree. And pears grew on this tree in such abundance that all the creatures knew that in these hard times, when they came, they could go there and they would be able to survive whatever hardship was going on around them. So one by one, all of the creatures of the jungle started making their way towards this field so they could get some water and have some of those pears and get some nourishment. But Brer Tiger had parked himself by that tree and by that spring, and he would not let anybody come near it. Come near it, and I'll eat you. Well, needless to say, the creatures didn't go. And they were all going away. They were moping. They were saying, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And up props Brer Rabbit, making his way towards the spring, totally unfazed by anything, because that's how Brer Rabbit rolls. Well, he saw all the creatures leaving the spring, looking all down and hungry and thirsty. He said, what's going on? What's going on? Bro Tiger, he's moved in, and he won't let us have any water. He won't let us have any pears. Well, that's not right. This spring is for everybody. This pear tree is for everybody. We got to do something about it. Well, what are we going to do with Bro Tiger? He got those sharp claws and those sharp teeth and a bad attitude. So what are we going to do about it? Brer Rabbit said, listen here. I know just what to do. He called all of the creatures together, all of them, the big creatures and the small creatures, and he gave them their assignments because he had a plan. The next day, Brer Rabbit is walking with a big rope over his shoulder, and he's walking singing a song. There's a big wind coming, gonna blow all the creatures off the face of the earth. There's a big wind coming, there's a big wind coming, gonna blow all the creatures off the face of the earth. Now, Brer Tiger was sitting there and said, Brer Rabbit, what you doing over here? You can't have any of this water. You can't have it. He said, oh, I'm not here for any of that. There's a big problem. Brer Tiger, don't you know what's going on? There's a big wind coming. A big wind? Now, the signal was when Tiger responded, all of the big flying creatures had gotten into the trees, and they started flapping. They started flapping. All of them. The eagles, the hawks, The little creatures, the little flying creatures, they were the little bushes. They were flapping, shaking all the bushes. Big old bear had him two big old sticks and two hollow logs. He boom, 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 beating those hollow logs. It sounded like thunder. The little turtles, they were rolling around in another hollow log. There was all this noise. There was all this breeze. And Brother Tiger said, what's going on? What you talking about? Didn't you know there's this big wind? And I'm going to tie all these creatures down so they don't blow off the earth. Well, tie me down. Tie me down. No, Brother Tiger, I got other creatures. All these other creatures. You're too big. I can't. Don't tie me. Tie me down. Please, tie me down. Please, look. I'm up against the tree. Come on. Just tie me down. Brother Rabbit accommodated him. He tied him first his neck, then his arms and his legs. He said, okay now, Brett Tiger, can you move? No, I'm good. He said, okay. All right, y'all, you can stop. Come on. One by one, all the creatures started coming, and Brett Tiger said, what's going on? What's going on is that you're going to be on this tree until these ropes rot away. All the creatures are entitled to share this spring and to share in this pear tree, and you tried to keep it all for yourself? Well, maybe somebody will come and help you, but I doubt it. All of those creatures, they shared, and they learned, and that's the end of that. Okay. The next story I'm going to tell you, I have another folk tale for you, but first I want to tell you a personal story. I love to travel. I've been to about 30-something countries, getting ready to go to two or three more next month, going to South America to tell some stories down there. But I love to travel. Travel can be a wonderful experience. Can be a wonderful experience, and you can have some really great lessons. Sometimes some of those lessons come from some not-so-great experiences. And this is one of those situations. I call this story The Power of Love. Now, it was 1988, 1999, and I was traveling around the south of India, going to temples and ashrams and doing my own spiritual thing, getting my spiritual groove on. Now, some friends of mine had showed up in a town called Pondicherry to visit the Sri Aurobindo Ashram. I'd read about this place, always wanted to go there. My two friends went directly to the main ashram guest house, the park guest house, the hotel, and I told them I'd show up a little while later. Now, I wasn't worried about getting a room. It was the hot season in the south of India, 120 degrees in the shade. The guidebook said at this time of year, you didn't have to worry about getting a room because nobody in there right now would be there, except me and my friends. So, after an hour or so of roaming around the town, I showed up at the hotel. As I'm walking up the steps to the lobby of the hotel, I noticed that this elderly Indian woman gave me a real dirty look. And she said something to the man sitting behind the desk. I go up to this gentleman. He says, can I help you? I said, yes, I'd like a room. We don't have any rooms. Keys all over the board, up, down, and sideways. I said, well, does so-and-so and so-and-so check in, asking about my two friends who just happened to be white? He looked and said, well, yes, they did. Now, I'm picking up on something, duh. But I don't want to believe what I'm picking up on because I'm at an ashram, a spiritual place. But I maintain my spiritual equanimity. I said, well, when will you have some rooms? Maybe in a couple of days. All right, I go check in another hotel. The next morning, I'm having breakfast with my friends in this hotel restaurant, only place in town with whole wheat toast. I'm a whole wheat toast kind of guy. I see someone else I know who had checked into the hotel the previous evening after I'd been by there. Now, I maintain a positive attitude. Some rooms must have suddenly become available. So I go to the lobby to check it out. And there's that woman, the one who had given me the dirty look. There she is checking some people in. So I'm standing off to the side waiting for her to take care of the business. She looks at me and says, what do you want with attitude? I said, well, I came to see if you had some rooms available. No, we don't have any rooms for you. This isn't just some hotel. This is for people who are coming for the Sri Aurobindo Ashram. Like I'm halfway around the world and I don't know this. Now, I am perturbed. I've had enough of this town. I've had enough of this ashram. I make arrangements to leave the following evening. The next morning, I come back to have breakfast with my friends in this hotel restaurant. I am physically barred from entering and told that I have to go get this person's permission to go in. Time out. You're talking about your former 60s militant type, you know? I know how to yell, scream, cuss, and fuss. Ain't done it in a while, but I still remember how. But I maintain my spiritual equanimity. I go to the lobby, and I say, "Madam, is there some problem? I'm just going to have breakfast with my friends. May I go in?" "No, you can't go in. You go and wait in the lobby. It's on now." She done messed with the wrong person now. I'm getting ready to raise some cane up in here. And I'm working myself up. There's steam coming out like in the car. All of a sudden, this voice in my head says, "This is a test. It's easy to love those that love you. The test is to love those that hate you." And I figure this woman qualifies. Now, you must understand, love was not uppermost in my mind in terms of things that I wanted to send her. Maybe the Fred Sanford kind of love. And I'm thinking, how am I going to send this person love? I love it. And then I remember reading something about auras, the energy that surrounds every living thing. And I remember reading that pink was the color that represented divine love. So mentally, I enveloped her in a bubble of pink light. And I started pumping pink at her butt. I mean, I was pumping pink, I was pumping pink, I was pumping pink. I worked up a sweat pumping pink. I mean, I pumped pink, I don't know, 5-10 minutes. Suddenly, the woman comes over to me, totally different demeanor, totally different tone of voice. "Are your friends in the restaurant?" I'm from Chicago, we'd be suspicious. I'm like, "What's up, I'm getting set up, what's up?" I said, "I don't know, you wouldn't let me go see." She says, "Oh, we'll go. Please go." And she personally escorted me into the restaurant. And as I walked into the restaurant, looking back at her still smiling sweetly at me, I had realized that I had experienced the power of love. Now, a few years later, I would become a professional storyteller. I told this story at Community Storytelling in Los Angeles, and after the meeting, people were coming up, "Oh, Michael, that's a wonderful story, that's a wonderful story." And I am someone who is not uncomfortable receiving praise. You might want to remember that for later. So this one friend seemed to be particularly moved by the story. A few months later, after the same meeting, she said, Michael, let me tell you what happened. It seems that at her job, her boss had decided to give her unholy, you know, each and every day. This particular day, my friend decided she was not going to react normally, but she would do the pink thing. She would send her love. If not love, light. If not light, you wouldn't send those, "I want to choke you around your neck" thoughts. You do the best you can. So she was doing this all morning. At lunch, all the employees were in a little lunchroom. My friend sitting here talking to someone over there. The boss sitting next to her talking to someone over there. When suddenly the boss turned to her and started to engage her in pleasant, complimentary conversation. And from that day on, there was no more mess between them. The power of love. Now, I'm going to fess up. I passed that first test, but I have flunked quite a few. But it is worth the effort, and that's the end of that. How much time do I have left? Okay, I'll tell you one more story. So many stories, so little time. This is a story that has to do with our interaction. Well, you figured out. You grown folks, you know what's going on. It's a story from Ghana, from the Ashanti tribe. The rat, the deer, and the hunter. Once there was a hunter who, although a good hunter, he was having the worst luck. He wasn't catching anything. He couldn't catch a cold if they caught colds over there. he was so poor, his wife and his children, they would work on other people's properties so they could get a little food, but they were just scuffling each and every day. One day, after hunting all day long, he had found absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. He saw a rat. He said, well, a rat is something. So he aimed to get that rat, and the rat, again, this is a folktale, said, oh no, please. I have a wife. I have children. Please don't hurt me. Please don't hurt me. And he said, look, I'm hungry. The rat said, look, I'm so small. I can't possibly beat you or your family. He said, look, I haven't caught anything. You're the first thing I've seen. He said, please, look, if you spare my life, perhaps one day I can help you. I can maybe help you out of your condition. He said, well, what can a rat do? You never know. Well, he thought about it. He was a good-hearted guy. He told the rat, look, I got to think about this, but I've got you. Now get in my bag, and I'll think about it. I swear, I'll think about it. Now, on his way home, he saw a deer. Oh, now this was great. Oh, okay, now I don't have to worry about the rat. And he aimed at the deer, and the deer said, oh, no, please, please, please don't hurt me. I know I look very healthy to you, but please don't hurt me. Please don't hurt me. I can one day perhaps help you. I may be able to do something for you. He said, deer, what could you possibly do? I can run fast. I got a dog that can run fast. But you never know. I might be able to help you one day. He said, well, okay, deer, look. You're looking like dinner. But I tell you what, I'll think about it. You come along with me. He went home. And the rat was continually pleading about his family. And the deer had those doe eyes. And he couldn't eat them. He couldn't kill them. He let them go. Well, he went to bed that night. He was used to going to bed hungry. He woke up the next morning, laying in the bed before getting up, just thinking, what is he going to do? How is he going to provide for his family? And he notices on the pillow beside him is a nugget of gold. He looks, takes a bite of it. It's the real thing. He gives it to his wife. Husbands, we know how to do things like that. You know, you give the money to your wife. And she went and bought some things for the family. Well, the next night, he went to sleep. Again, when he woke up in the morning, there was a little nugget of gold. And night after, for the next couple of weeks, every night he woke up, there was a little nugget of gold on his pillow. After about 2 weeks, the rat came by and said, oh, Hunter, I just wanted to thank you for saving my life. You seem to have had some good fortune. You seem to be getting a little belly there. And the man says, well, yes, I have. It's very confusing to me. I don't understand it. He said, well, perhaps you should talk to me about it. Perhaps I can help. Oh, no, you're just a little rat. You don't understand these things. He said, is it about the gold? What? How do you know about that? And the rat explained. There was a man in the village who was very, very rich, although he never told anybody he was rich, but everybody knew it. He was also very, very greedy. And he was beyond a miser, because this was a man who had taken gold and land from people all of his life. And he had lived a very long life. But he told everybody he was poor. But the rat explained that he had gold that he kept buried under his hut. People had tried to break in and found his gold, but never found it because of he had hid it so well. But the rat had made a little tunnel from this greedy man's house to the hunter's house. And he said, every day, as long as I can, I will bring you a nugget of gold. Well, needless to say, the quality of the hunter's life changed considerably. He had food. He had clothing. Probably got himself an iPod, iPhone. Bought land. And he was very generous. Because when he prospered, not only his family, but anyone around him, people who were poor, he helped them. Meanwhile, the miser was noticing that his gold was disappearing. And he started complaining about it. But at first, nobody paid attention since he was a miser. Nobody particularly liked him, but he paid people real well. So he had them searching and searching and searching. They set up guards and what have you, but the gold was still disappearing. Then somebody noticed that this hunter's life had gotten real good about the same time that this miser started complaining about his gold missing. So one day the hunter was at home when all of a sudden up runs a deer. He says, "Oh, I'm surprised to see you. I haven't seen you in so long." He says, "Yes, yes. Listen, I was laying in the fields. The rat told me about what he's been doing for you. There's a group of men. They're on their way here. The miser has hired them to search your house. If they find gold in your house, they will hurt you. They will put you in prison. They may kill you. You don't have time to hide it. Give it to me. I will swallow it. And then you just keep me. And when you need the gold, you can kill me because you've let me live such a long life." Well, he fed the gold to the deer. The men came to the house and searched, and of course they found nothing. And the man was very gracious, offered him some tea and crumpets and things. The deer, he would not kill. He said, "You have saved me. I will feed you and I will care for you until you die of natural causes." One day the rat came to him and said, "I think that I have repaid my debt to you. I don't want to take all of this man's gold, even though he is a miser. He has enough gold to live out the rest of his life comfortably. If it's okay with you, I will now retire." He said, "Yes." He said, "And you may come to my home and I will feed you whenever you need. You may stay here." And for the rest of those creatures' lives, he took care of them. And when that deer died, only then did he cut him open and take out the gold. But he would not eat the deer. He gave him a funeral. People were amazed. You've been feeding this deer all this time. They didn't understand. And he told the rat before he died, "Because you and the deer have been so good to me, so loyal to me, more than even a human might have been, I vow that I will never kill another animal or eat meat again." And he kept that vow until the end of his life. And that's the end of that. Thank you very much. I'm going to give you an option. I have a folk tale or a story about my daughter. All right, good choice. I call this story, "That's My Baby." Now, when my daughter was born, it was very, very clear there were certain things she had inherited from moi. Besides good looks, the girl was loud. You know how some babies cry? Not my daughter, Carla. Could cry for hours on end. Now, when my daughter was little, she was such a sweet, obedient child. She would rush home from school to do her homework and then help her friends with their homework. She always wanted to do exactly as she was told. Let me give an example. All of this takes place in Chicago. I would drop her off at her elementary school. Now, when she was very, very young, I would walk her across the street to the school. As she got older, I would make sure there was no traffic coming, and then let her go across the street on her own. Well, one morning, I pull up in front of the school. There's no traffic coming. I say, "Okay, Carla, you can go across the street."
"But, Daddy, they told us we have to cross the street down there."
At the other end of the block where there was a crossing guard, I said, "Yes, baby, they want somebody to look out for you. That's what I'm doing, so it's okay for you to cross the street here."
"But, Daddy, they told us we have to cross the street down there."
I said, "Carla, they don't want you to get hit by a car. Neither do I. So it's okay for you to cross the street."
"But Daddy, get across that street."
And I watched her walk into the school. Usually this is when I would pull off, but something made me wait. I just pulled across the next intersection behind another car and watched my daughter coming back out of school, walking down the street, so she can go across the street and then come back across like she was supposed to. She was such a sweet, obedient child. And then she became a... Those of you who have them or have had them, you know of what I speak. One day you have this child who looks at you lovingly. Oh, mommy. Oh, daddy, I love you so much. And the next day they're like, whatever. Talk to the hand. Am I really related to you? I'm so smart. Where did it come from? Now, one of the greatest challenges for fathers of daughters during the teenage years is boyfriends. There's this whole program that kicks in with fathers when it comes to meeting boyfriends. In fact, there's an unwritten rule of fatherhood. You cannot smile when you first meet a boyfriend unless you have a weapon. I learned that from a father of a girlfriend in high school, but that's another story. So my daughter's about 12 or 13 years old. My sister tells me, Carla's out on the front porch with her boyfriend. I'm going to bring him in to meet you. And I said, okay, because you got to have your father voice. And you got to have a crazed look in your eye. And if you can make your eyeballs go in different directions, that's all good. And if not, or to supplement that, at a strategic point in the conversation with the young boy, you let a big glob of drool drop out your mouth. So my sister brings the little boy in. He's obviously all nervous. And I take his little hand. And he's looking at me. I said, boy, you ain't got to be scared. They made me put my guns away. And then I let that glob of drool drop. Little boy liked to pass out. Now, this took place around 1983. I did not meet another one of my daughter's boyfriends until about 3-4 years ago. Word got out. So now my daughter's in high school, in her junior year in high school, and she got good grades all the way up until about the middle of her junior year in high school. And she got that attitude. And she started bringing home these mediocre grades. Well, one day, I don't remember, she brought home a C, a D, maybe an F. But her mother didn't get mad. Now, her mother's a brilliant woman who has never known anything but an A from kindergarten to her doctorate. She kept telling her, you got to do better, you got to do better. She comes home with this lousy grade, but her mother doesn't get mad. She says, you don't want to study? That's just fine. The next day, she went with her to school and withdrew her from school. She said, you go get a job, a full-time job, 40 hours a week, and all the overtime I can stand you doing. Free ride was over. My daughter calls me up. Daddy. I said, look, Carla, you're old enough to take the GED, get your equivalency diploma. You can go to a junior college or a small college, take some classes until you figure out what you want to do. Okay. She recovered quickly. She goes to Columbia College in Chicago, takes a writing class because she likes to write. One of the first assignments they had to write about a moment of transformation in their lives, and this is what she wrote about. When she was about 9 or 10 years old, her and her little buddies her age like to hang out with these older girls. Now, you know what older meant? They were like a half a year older, which made them like Yoda, okay? Now, these older girls like to talk about things and do things that Carla and her little friends had no interest in or knew they shouldn't be doing. These older girls like to talk about boys. Carla and her little friends, they didn't care about no boys, but the older girls did, so it was okay. These older girls like to sneak off and try to smoke cigarettes and use cuss words, and Carla and her little friends, they knew they shouldn't do that. But the older girls did it, so it was okay. One day, one of these older girls announced she was having a birthday party, was giving out invitations to all the kids in the neighborhood, everybody except my daughter, Carla. And at first, she thought it was an oversight, but it became clear that it was not. She kept trying to get invited all the way up until the day of the party, but she was literally turned away at the door. As she sat in the window, because the party was right across the street, as she sat in the window watching all the rest of her friends going to that party, she vowed then and there that never again in her life would she compromise her principles or beliefs to be with any individual or any group of people. She was 9 or 10 years old. I know people 30, 40, 90 years old haven't figured that out yet. She keeps taking classes and decides she wants to become a teacher. And in 1995, she graduated from the University of Illinois in Chicago with a degree in education. Just before the graduation ceremony was about to commence, I pulled my daughter to the side and said, Carla, it is my right, it is my duty as your father to embarrass you at this wonderful moment in your life. I said, when you go up there, you go across that stage to get your diploma, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to yell at the top of my lungs, that's my baby! Not only did I do that, I didn't just stand up at my feet. I walked up to the front of the auditorium. I stood in front of those hundreds of people. And when my daughter crossed that stage, I pointed at her, yelled it much louder than it did just now. Now, my daughter knows me. She knows that I am going to do this. There is no escape. She's okay. Okay, daddy. But daddy, please, daddy, don't do your yell. I hadn't even thought about it. And that's the end of that.